From NPR, it's Latino USA. Take a minute now and tune your radio.
Las 12 de la noche, 16 minutos. Bienvenidos todos nuestros oyentes en la selva.
And you'll find Voces del Secuestro, Kidnap Radio, the lifeline for Colombians who have been kidnapped and for their families.
Hola, papito. Pido a Dios por tu pronta liberación y la de los demás secuestrados.
Buenos días, mi hermanito. ¿Cómo estás?
Nos imaginamos cómo estarás allá en la selva.
Papito, te amo con todo mi corazón.
On today's program, the story of how a radio show gave a kidnapped man and his family hope and comfort, and how it still offers that hope to many more. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us.
Yo comencé a escribir sobre esto después de la acusación contra Corea del Norte.
There he was, on Cuban television after years of silence and few sightings. Fidel Castro delivered what he always does, strong words for the United States, woven with ideas on Iran, South Korea, and the fate of humanity. He never mentioned the unexpected news that 52 political prisoners were getting ready to leave Cuba. The prisoners, thin and pale, were loaded onto planes with members of their extended families and flown to Spain. In the coming days and weeks, Cuba promises to release more, in all, 52 dissidents. These men were originally arrested in the spring of 2003 and called criminals by the Cuban government. Joining us now is Chicago Tribune reporter Gary Marks, who was based in Havana, Cuba at the time of the arrests. Gary, welcome back to Latino USA.
Thanks, Maria.
So, Gary, set the scene for us. What was going on in Cuba in the spring of 2003?
Well, the spring of 2003 was incredibly tense. I mean, in the run-up to that period, of course, you had the end of the Clinton administration, in which tension between the two countries had eased quite a bit. There were thousands of Americans traveling to Cuba each month on licenses that were given out, and U.S. businesses were really pushing to ease the embargo up. There had been a huge U.S. ag trade fair in Havana in which hundreds of U.S. businesses participated. So that was sort of the end of the Clinton administration. The Bush administration came in, and in the beginning of really 2003, they began ratcheting up the pressure on the Cuban government. A new U.S. envoy, James Kaysen, was stationed there, and he began meeting openly with dissidents. He actually called out Fidel Castro at one point, saying that Fidel was afraid of his own people and that he was afraid of human rights, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you don't really do that in Fidel's house without sparking a response. And, of course, that's when the dissidents were arrested shortly after that.
And so who are these men who were arrested?
Most of the people who were arrested were fairly low-profile dissidents. You have to understand, they have no profile in Cuba in the sense that they're not covered in the media. They don't have access to the media. So most Cubans, the only thing they know about these individuals are what they're told by the Cuban state-run media, which is they are mercenaries of the United States, they're gusanos, they're people who are making money from the U.S. by acting as dissidents. Most of them were, you know, sort of leaders of small independent labor unions. They were independent journalists writing for websites and publications overseas, not for consumption inside Cuba. You know, many were local members of the Varela Project, which they'd gathered, you know, tens of thousands of signatures to try to get the Cuban National Assembly to enact democratic reforms.
So these people, they were not well known before they were arrested. What about after they were arrested? I mean, did people remember about them? How did this story stay alive?
You know, there's two stories here. One is the story overseas, which is that, you know, the dissidents attained a high profile overseas after their arrest. The European Union immediately took a strong stance against this. The U.S. government did as well. Human rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch followed this very closely and kept it in the news overseas. So the arrest of the dissidents had a major impact overseas. Internally, it had a very small impact. Like I said before, you know, they're not covered in the media. They don't have access to the state-controlled media. Many Cubans were not even aware that these arrests had taken place.
So what do you read into the choice of the Cuban government to release this group of prisoners now?
I mean, it's very hard to say, Maria, what it means, to be honest with you. You know, many people are speculating that Raul Castro wants to try to influence U.S. policy to improve relations. But what I can say is that there have been prisoner releases like this in the past. It's obviously significant in the sense that, you know, there are far fewer political prisoners in Cuba today than there were a week ago or even a year ago. But in the macro sense, not much has changed. The repressive apparatus in Cuba remains in place. You know, there are no real protections for individual human rights as we understand them.
All right, Gary, thanks for that update.
Thanks, Maria.
Gary Marks is now based in Chicago for the Tribune. And remember, for news of the week, go to our website at latinousa.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter, where we are LatinoUSA, all one word. Back in 30 segundos. No se vayan. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Urban terrorism can take many forms. And for years in Colombia, in South America, that terrorism comes in an instant. A car is stopped, a person is taken. And in an instant, that person is changed from a mother, a father, into a hostage. Today, we share the story of Annie Correal and her family. You've heard Annie report on our show before, but this is her family story. It was produced for Transom.org with Jay Ellison.
There's a radio station in Bogota, Colombia, where 10 years ago, my family used to go on the air every week. The station still broadcasts the show they were on. It's so popular that hundreds of people call in every Saturday to send out a message. But they're not calling to ramble about politics or soccer. They're calling to send messages to their kidnapped relatives. The show is called Voces del Secuestro, or Voices of Kidnapping.
Las 12 de la noche, 16 minutos. Bienvenidos todos nuestros oyentes en la selva de Colombia. Aquí estamos.
The host kicks off the show welcoming all the hostages in the jungles of Colombia. Most families call in with their messages.
Hola, papito. Pido a Dios por tu pronta liberación y la de los demás secuestrados.
Buenos días, mi hermanito. ¿Cómo estás?
Nos imaginamos cómo estará allá en la selva.
Papito, te amo con todo mi corazón. Chao.
But some people actually come into the station, like Viviana. Her dad, Edgar Yacid Duarte, is a police commander who was kidnapped in 1998. Tomorrow is her 13th birthday, and rather than run the risk of not getting on the air, Viviana and her mom are spending the night at the radio station. She always sends a message to mark her birthday, and she wants to make sure she can this year. She says she wants to send her dad a message because tomorrow is her birthday. She says it's an important day in their lives, and she just knows he's going to be there next year, that they're going to free him this year, so he won't miss any more special dates in their lives. She tells him she loves him, and she sends him a blessing.
Papito, te quiero mucho. Te mando una bendición grandísima. Que Dios y la Virgen te acompañen siempre.
I know how she feels. My dad was kidnapped by the FARC, the same rebel group who kidnapped Viviana's dad. The FARC is an army of leftist guerrillas that kidnaps people for political reasons, but also civilians like my dad, for money. My dad, Jaime Correal, was kidnapped on his way home from work in 1999.
There was a guy in a motorcycle back there. But I didn't think anything of it. I didn't notice I was being followed.
This year, when I went back to Colombia, my dad and I drove through a park, up a winding, isolated road, to the spot on the highway where it happened.
Right where I'm standing, the guy came from behind that post, And he came with the gun up, screaming, police, police. I tried to get into the traffic, and I couldn't get in because it was bumper to bumper. And that's when they hit the window, and they pulled me out, and they threw me in the back seat with two guys with a weapon.
Back then, Colombia was the kidnapping capital of the world. At the peak of the kidnapping craze, there were around 3,000 people kidnapped a year. That's like 8 people a day. Carjackings happened in Bogota all the time, and in plain view, like my dad's.
You know, I had in my mind that it was not so close to the road, but it's right there.
Is that the first time you've been back to that spot?
Uh-huh. Yep.
As we sat at the spot where it happened, he said if he had taken a left, it would have taken him 20 minutes to get home.
He said it took me 8.5 months. 265 days.
While my dad was kidnapped, I was in the States. But my stepmom, Sammy, used to call into the radio show, Voices of Kidnapping, and try to get word out from our family. And some of our messages actually got through. When my dad was rescued 8.5 months later, he told us he had had a radio and had listened for us, obsessively.
It was a black machine. I don't know. It wasn't a brand name that everybody knows. It was something like cauliflower, okay? it was as valuable as my cigarettes, okay? It's something I would wrap really well with my clothes so it wouldn't get hurt, it wouldn't get damaged.
Although it was the military that ultimately got my dad out of the jungle, I think it was that radio that actually saved his life. A guard gave it to him at the first camp, and he held on to it for most of his kidnapping. Radios aren't officially allowed, but they're passed around as contraband, and guards usually turn a blind eye. For the first 6 months he was held captive by the FARC, my dad was held alone. The radio was his only companion.
It's really an exercise of patience to be awake for 12 hours, 13 hours, and not being able to do anything.
So when he first heard my stepmom, Sammy, talking to him over the radio, it was like a miracle.
You know, it was like 6:20 in the morning. I was laying in bed with my radio. I said, this is a message for Jaime Corral. I mean, my heart stopped. I said, wow. She said, your kids are fine. Hold up, pray, you know, all the encouraging words I can give you. So from there on, that was my lifeline.
This is a radio message from my family, recorded 10 years ago, when my dad was held captive. My stepmom made this tape to send to the radio station, hoping he would hear it, wherever he was. She calls him by his nickname, Lumpy.
My Lumpy, quiero dedicarte esa canción.
From this moment, life has begun.
She chose one of her favorite love songs to mix with the radio message.
Cada vez que la escucho, te pienso intensamente. Lampi, ¿tú te alcanzas a imaginar lo que vamos a gozar recuperando esto?
She says every time she hears it, she thinks of him, intensely. She asks if he can imagine how much they're going to enjoy making up for lost time. Then she introduces my little sister.
Hola, papi, hablas con Lori. Espero que vuelvas muy pronto, sano y salvo.
My little sister says she hopes he comes back soon, safe and sound.
Mucho, mucha hambre.
And that he'll be very, very, very hungry because they'll have his favorite, eggs and sausage, waiting for him. Then my brother comes on.
Hola, papi, hablas con Nicolás. Mira que hoy jugué mucho de fútbol y me tapé muchos tiros.
He says he's the goalie on the school soccer team and he's blocked a lot of shots. Then he says he loves him and misses him. My stepmom says that she's waiting for him, that she'll always wait for him, and he's the love of her life, and she can't wait to pick up where they left off in November.
I love you, your Samuelson. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao, ciao. Mwah. Te mando un besito.
Mwah. These days, the number of new kidnappings is way down. They're just a few hundred a year. And that's a good thing, but it conceals something basic. The fact is that thousands of people who were kidnapped never came back. There are thousands of families who are still waiting for their husbands and fathers to be released. I went to Colombia this year to find some of them, to talk to them. The first person I met was Viviana, the girl who was celebrating her 13th birthday at the radio station. Viviana's dad has been gone for 11 years, almost her entire life. He's part of a small group of political prisoners that the FARC won't free unless the government agrees to a prisoner exchange. So there's nothing the family can do but wait. Everything Viviana knows about her dad fits easily on top of a coffee table. There's a pile of notebooks filled with his colored pencil drawings, the rusted aviator glasses he was wearing when he was kidnapped, and a few photographs and videos the FARC has sent as proof that he is alive. Viviana was so young when her dad was kidnapped that her only images of him come from those photos and videos. She says he's in the jungle, but it's impossible to know where he is because he's posed against a sheet. I remember getting a proof of life. It's like seeing something from another world. My dad, next to a tree, in sweatpants and a peasant sweater. My dad is a prisoner. I asked Viviana what her dad looked like in these proofs of life. She says, in the older photos, he used to look normal, chubby. But in the recent videos, he's looking thin and he's going bald. She says that's hard, because he used to look stronger. She says she thinks to herself, no, why is he like that? Life is hard. To cope, Viviana still talks to her dad, and not just over the radio. She says it's not that she feels that he's here. It's that she talks to him in her head. I talked to my dad in my head, too. I consulted him about what to major in, and I asked for his help at exam time. When my mood would plummet, I would think it was somehow connected to what he was going through. And in the worst moments, when I wouldn't feel his presence, I'd look outside and say, if he's alive, let there be a sign in the next 60 seconds. And I'd count down. And inevitably, a dog would bark, or a streetlight would turn on. It's like sending the radio messages. You send these little telepathic messages, and you start to believe someone is out there, listening.
That was a terrible time for all the family.
Marco was 18 when his dad was kidnapped. His dad, Marco Aurelio Guerra, was not a political prisoner, though. Like my dad, he was kidnapped for ransom. His family delivered the money back in 1998. But the FARC didn't keep up their end of the bargain. Marco never saw his dad again.
I become the man of the family. And I take care of my mom, my sisters.
They continue to send messages on the radio, even though they haven't received a proof of life in a decade. And he was in his 70s and ill when he was kidnapped.
I don't know. I am so sad. I think I feel that my only friend, my best friend, is not with me anymore. I think that is not easy to change. It's not easy.
It was hard for me to talk to Marco. If things had gone differently, that could have been my life. But when Marco looked at me, was he thinking the same thing? I asked him what he felt when he heard other people were released.
Happiness, because they are in the same situation that I am. Today, they are happy. Tomorrow, maybe, my family and I were happy.
Stay with us for more stories from Annie Correal and Voces del Secuestro, Kidnap Radio. We're back in a minute. No se vayan.
Thank you.
You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We return now to our documentary, Kidnap Radio, Voces del Secuestro, from reporter Annie Correal.
One of the thousands of people who disappeared is named Daniel Velasquez. He went missing 5 years ago when he was 20. The day it happened, he called his sister, Lena, and asked if he could go into her room and borrow some money to go to McDonald's before class. And that was it. He was never heard from again.
When this situation starts, you never know what to do.
In Daniel's case, there was no word at all. No demand for ransom from the FARC, no clues from the police, nothing. Kidnapping was still so rampant in Colombia, the police scarcely investigated cases of missing people, and the government lost an accurate count.
It's a really high number of people that is lost in this moment. You can find poor people or rich people, it's the same. But families without any news, there are too many.
Lena's family looked in the streets and parks for Daniel. Then they went to the morgues. They hung posters in airports and train stations. But the only calls they got were from people trying to take advantage of them.
You start looking for the person, and you can find the bad side of the world. You can see too many things.
Like psychics or mediums, who Lena said called her house by the dozen, claiming they could tell her where her brother was, for a price. They would point at a city on the map, and off the family would go.
I think that we visit around 30 or more different places, different cities.
It was easier to keep searching, to believe Daniel was kidnapped and held captive somewhere, than to give him up for dead.
I don't feel that he's dead. I think that when you are close to a person, you can feel some things. I feel that he is alive. I feel that he's alive in my heart. They used to play this part in the guitar.
When Daniel disappeared, he was learning to play the guitar. Late at night, Lena still listens to the song Daniel used to play for her.
I always keep the music in my computer because when I want to remember, when I want to stay close to him, I put the music. My husband hates that because I start crying. And he said, Lena, please stop. So it's my special moment when I am alone.
I was one of the lucky ones. It might seem strange to call a kidnapping lucky, but my dad came back. The kidnapping turned our lives upside down, but he came back. 8.5 months after he was taken on the highway, my dad was rescued by the Colombian military. A 17-year-old rebel soldier, a girl, deserted. Then she took back a group of 60 military soldiers to the camp where my dad and several other hostages were held. They ambushed the camp on a Sunday morning in August.
There was a lot of screaming and there was also grenades being thrown. It was, combat. And all of a sudden, silence, total silence. And then you don't know what's going on. And then I see this guy, he looked like a Rambo with a bandana, with a big M60. The guy got close to us and he said, guys, you are free men. From here on, this is the Army of the Republic of Colombia.
It was the largest hostage rescue in Colombian history at the time. 5 hostages were freed, and my dad was one of them. That night, he landed in a little plane in Bogota. This is the sound of the plane landing from a newscast at the time.
Then we landed, and then the propeller's going... So I'm the first one to go down the steps, and I could hear, it was a big crowd, like Rolling Stones had arrived. I could hear everybody screaming, yeah, everybody yelling. Right? And I see Sammy with the 2 kids running towards me. And we just, wow, embraced. Oh, and we couldn't let go of each other. It was such a big sensation, everything together, you know, the lights of the flashes, the screaming of the people, the noise, everybody moving, seeing so many people. And most of that, you know, the sensation of being free, you can't believe it.
It wasn't a happy ending altogether. My dad's business had gone bankrupt while he was gone, and he soon decided to leave the country. But before he left, he called the radio station to send out a message of his own.
What did you say in your message?
I said something that I had lost faith, that I was in kind of despair because it had taken too long, that I had my little quarrels with God, which was normal, because he listens to what you say, but he decides what to do. And that things can change very, very quick. And don't lose hope, because although now you think you're lost in the middle of the jungle, in 5 minutes you could be out. So keep that hope. That was my message. And, you know, that I would be thinking about them every day of my life. And I think of them, of the people in the jungle, every day of my life.
Viviana's dad, Marco's dad, so many people's dads and moms and brothers. They're the lost people, the disappeared. The radio show that started as a lifeline for them has become a memorial. Or that's the way we might see it, from a safe distance. The people who produce the radio show and the families who still send messages don't see it that way. And I realized, if my dad were one of them, if he hadn't come back, I wouldn't see it that way either. I'd be just like them, going to bed every night thinking of him, staying up all night on Saturdays to get on the radio just to send him a message. My family was spared that life. Like my dad, we were rescued.
Our documentary, Kidnap Radio, was produced by Annie Correal with Jay Allison of the public radio website transom.org. For the connection, you can start at latinousa.org. And for this week, that's Latino USA. The program comes to you from the Futuro Media Group, online at futuromediagroup.org, and is produced in cooperation with KUT Austin. You can stay connected to Latino USA throughout the week at latinousa.org, or for news, follow us on Twitter. We are Latino USA, all one word. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Lumber Liquidators, whose flooring includes pre-finished and stained solid hardwoods, bamboo, cork, and laminates. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.